afternoon, and welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Sonia Hilgren, and I am a member of the Board of Governors of the National Press Club and Washington editor of Farm Journal. I'd like to welcome club members and their guests in the audience today, as well as those of you watching on C-SPAN or listening to the program on National Public Radio or the Global Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I would like to remind our members of upcoming speakers. On May 25th, Hazel O'Leary, Secretary of Energy, will discuss the Clinton administration energy policy, including the BTU tax. On May 27th, Alejandra Junco, President of the Inter-American Press Association, will discuss abuses of press freedoms throughout Latin America. And on Thursday, June 3rd, the Reverend Ben Chavis, Executive Secretary of the NAACP, will talk about the NAACP and a changing world. Other upcoming luncheon speakers include former President Gerald Ford, George Washington University Economics Professor Dr. Amitai Etzioni, the President of Planned Parenthood Pamela Moraldo, Undersea Explorer Dr. Robert Ballard, former Ambassador to Russia Robert Strauss, and EPA Administrator Carol Browner. Audio and videotapes of Press Club luncheons are available through the National Press Club Library or by calling 1-800-952-TAPE. If you have any questions for our speaker, please write them down in the cards provided at your table and pass them up to me. I will ask as many questions as time permits. Our speaker today, Secretary of Commerce Ronald H. Brown, is a man who isn't afraid to take on big challenges. Raised in Harlem, where his father managed the Teresa Hotel, Ron Brown was the only African-American in his class at Middlebury College in Vermont. He worked as a welfare caseworker in New York City, attended law school at night at St. John's University, where he met a professor named Mario Cuomo, and he served 4 years in the Army in Germany and Korea. For 12 years, Mr. Brown worked in high positions at the National Urban League, lobbying for equal rights and opportunities for Afro-Americans. He served as deputy campaign manager in Senator Edward Kennedy's bid for the Democratic presidential nomination, an effort that softened up President Carter for defeat by another Ronald, that is, Reagan. In 1981, Mr. Brown joined the Washington law firm of Patton, Boggs, and Blow. When Jesse Jackson made his bid for the Democratic nomination in 1988, he picked Ron Brown to be his convention manager. Mr. Brown has been a leader at various levels of the Democratic Party for more than 20 years. His skills as a negotiator and conciliator won him the daunting job of Democratic National Committee chairman in 1988. His success in solidifying a splintered party helped make possible Bill Clinton's victory last November. And now, as Secretary of Commerce, Brown faces another tough challenge: helping sell President Clinton's economic program to a skeptical public and a reluctant Congress. To make things even more challenging, the President directed his new Secretary of Commerce to find ways to invigorate the moribund economy of the nation's largest state, California. Now let's hear how he intends to do all that and more. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our speaker, Secretary of Commerce Ronald H. Brown.
Thank you very much, Sonia, for that kind and gracious introduction. It's always an honor and pleasure for me to be here with you at the National Press Club. I was talking to Reginald. I think this is either my third or fourth appearance here. I must acknowledge some very special person who was in the audience. So I looked up in the reception room over there, and there was a face that is very dear to me, and my college roommate showed up, so I know this must be an important speech. I'd like to introduce him, Tom Meehan, who is my Middlebury College. Tom, very distinguished lawyer here in Washington. This is truly an exciting time to be in government, a time of great challenge and, I think, great opportunity. And it's not just because you never know who on the Senate Finance Committee is going to do what next. But because notwithstanding the headlines, Bill Clinton really does understand and appreciate and respect the goals and aspirations and dreams of the American people. He understands the fundamental ways that the world has changed, and he's given those of us who are fortunate enough to serve in his administration an opportunity to help him to lead and transform our country. For too long in America, we have lacked a unifying national vision which inspires our people. Federal agencies too often worked at cross purposes. Labor and management have fought one another. Government and the business community have often related not as allies, but rather as adversaries. Social progress and economic growth were held to be irreconcilable goals, as were creating jobs and protecting the environment. Our only common bonds, it seemed, were cynicism and disillusionment. The fact that we really all held a common stake in the future of our nation was too often dismissed or ignored as we have splintered into factions. And our leaders too often have played us one against another for short-term political gain. The Clinton administration is committed to bringing our nation and its peoples together. We are committed to ending the divisions that tear at the very fabric of American society. We are committed to redefining and forging a whole new set of relationships in America, relationships between and among the units of the federal government, relationships between federal, state, county, and local government, and most importantly, the relationship between the public and private sectors and the relationship between the people of America and their government. We believe that America's social and economic goals are two sides of the same coin. Last November 3rd, over 100 million Americans went to the polls and voted to fundamentally change the direction of our nation. Unfortunately, there are some in Washington who don't seem to realize we had an election at all last November. And there are too many others, apparently, who believe that elections in and of themselves create change, when in reality we know that they only create the opportunity for change. For the first time in years, turnout was up, as the American people resoundingly rejected gridlock politics and special interest cynicism. The American people embraced the idea that this great nation of ours must accept the reality of a changing world and change itself to meet our new challenges by investing more in our people and our communities, by cutting the deficit, by reforming our healthcare system, by rewarding investment and research, and by putting behind us the rhetoric and tactics which have for too long divided us by sector, by race, by income, by geography, and by gender. We elected Bill Clinton to lead us through this period of change and extraordinary opportunity, and he has made a bold, courageous, and inspiring beginning. President Clinton is leading us by confronting the biggest challenges of our lifetime, challenges whose existence no recent administration has been willing to acknowledge, no less confront. Restoring economic growth, reforming the healthcare system, and credibly reducing the national deficit and debt. Our goals are simple yet profound. A rising standard of living and expanding economic opportunities for the American people. Bringing sustained economic growth to a more just and inclusive America. I am convinced that our goals can only be achieved by forging a new public-private relationship and by bringing every sector of our society into the political process and the economic mainstream. But all of this is at risk unless we can overcome the politics of obstruction. Not only is economic revitalization endangered, but so are the other initiatives for which the American people elected Bill Clinton. Environmental protection, a defense conversion plan that eases the transition to a peacetime economy, an expansion of the college loan program, the welfare reform the American people demand, a campaign finance reform plan which shifts electoral power back to individual American citizens. Unless we act now, the federal deficit will hit $653 billion annually in 10 years. The national debt will be at $7.5 trillion, and interest payments will cost $437 billion each year. Worse yet, the health care system. The health care system is in a mess, and it must be improved. If we do nothing by the year 2000, $1 in five earned by Americans will go towards the $1.6 trillion annual health care bill. What amazes me is that the very people who are fighting reform are the same people who watched our decline into debtor nation status and whose trickle-down, borrow-and-spend economic policies contributed mightily to the quadrupling of our national debt over the last decade. What do they have to offer? Just the same short-term refrain that we've been hearing for the last 20 years. More of the status quo, more gridlock, more inaction. Now, I know that there are legitimate differences of opinion with the president. We respect those differences. And we know that there will be tough negotiations with committed members of the Congress on both sides of the aisle. We do not ask people to march in lockstep. We do not ask people to leave their conscience at the door. But playing politics with the future of our country is just plain unacceptable. The president has compromised in order to preserve the essence of his economic package and to preserve the hopes of the American people. He may well compromise again for the greater good. But the president understands what must be done to keep our nation great and strong. President Clinton's dedication to deficit reduction has pushed interest rates to their lowest levels in two decades. For many Americans, it's cheaper to start up a business or to buy a house today than it has ever been. President Clinton's budget resolution, which was adopted in record time, marries the best of both sides of the aisle. Earned income tax credits for the working poor, college opportunities for middle-class students, and civilian technology programs to revitalize American business, along with a balanced deficit reduction plan. And practically before the cherry trees had lost their blossoms, the president had signed into law motor voter and family leave legislation and had rescinded the gag rule. And now President Clinton is developing a health care plan that will control costs and ensure every American will have access to affordable, quality health care. For too long, we have put off addressing issues of critical importance to our country. Most of the pain has been borne by the middle class and lower income Americans, the people who truly are the backbone of our nation, resulting in loss of jobs and loss of faith in our economy. But real life is not like a superficial history book, where FDR is sworn in on page 55 and by page 56, a New Deal is in place. Change demands leadership, it demands patience, and it demands the courage to make the tough decisions. And strong leadership is the ability to see past the difficulties of the short run, and this president clearly does. At the Commerce Department, the message of the 1992 election drives our mission to ensure and enhance economic opportunity for the American people. We are working with the private sector on a groundbreaking, critical national technology effort which will make America the most productive and competitive nation on the face of this earth. And that's why I'm so pleased to have with me today Dr. Mary Lo Good, who is presently the Senior Vice President for Research and Technology at Allied Signal Corporation. She has in the past served as the Chair of the National Science Board and as Chair of the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology. She is my nominee, my recommendation, and the President's nominee to be the new Undersecretary for Technology at the Department of Commerce. We ought to give Mary Lo Good another round of applause. Our technology effort must, of course, be driven by the private sector, which will originate ideas and technology. Our role will be to fund widely applicable research, to set the standards, and to see that knowledge and information are widely disseminated among industries which can use it to become more productive. Abroad, the federal government will take the lead, working to assure that markets for American products are open and unimpeded. And the President is actively supporting democratization and privatization abroad, which will open up new markets for American products. Again, we must collaborate, government and the private sector. For so long in America, we've had this debate about whether we ought to have something that some called a national industrial policy. Those words scared a lot of people. But I will tell you, my friends, if we don't have some kind of national economic strategy in America, we're going to be a second-rate nation before we know it. We've got to adopt a new kind of partnership that brings government and the private sector together, working towards common goals with a common agenda. Private sector information and insight must always help to guide our negotiations. And private sector needs must define our goals. Domestic and international pursuits are more and more two parts of the whole. Our national security is increasingly dependent upon our economic security. And as we talk about forging this new kind of relationship, we in the Clinton administration clearly understand that it is the private sector that fuels the engine that pulls the train of economic growth and job creation. That is clear to us. It's clear to us that there are times when government needs to get out of the way, where we need to streamline, where we need to cut red tape and bureaucracy. There are also times in which we can be a much better and more effective partner than we've been in the past. And we look at our economic performance over the past several years. About the only bright spot during these periods of recession and stagnation has been exports. But I don't think that we have scratched the surface on exports. And that's why this administration is focusing on trade as a principal element of economic recovery in America. And that's why we're focusing at the Commerce Department on export promotion. I've had the opportunity to make three important international trips since becoming Secretary of Commerce, and they demonstrate the thrust that we're taking, the aggressive, straightforward thrust that we're taking as far as trade and export promotion is concerned. The first trip was to Mexico to really promote NAFTA and to assure our friends and allies in Mexico that the Clinton administration has stayed consistent on this subject since the campaign. We're for NAFTA. We're for NAFTA with appropriate supplemental agreements on workers' rights and the environment and the possibility of sectoral surges. I know there's been a lot of speculation about whether the votes are there in Congress right now. This is no time to evaluate whether it's there. We haven't even started to sell the package yet because there is no package yet. We're in the middle of negotiating supplemental agreements. I am absolutely confident that we're going to get strong supplemental agreements, that they will make the NAFTA treaty not only acceptable but desirable. NAFTA is good not only for Mexico and Canada, it's good for the United States. It will create jobs here at home. And that was the essence of the conversations we had with President Salinas and his cabinet, with Mexican businessmen and women and American businessmen and women who are working in Mexico. Secondly was an opportunity to go to Japan and follow up to President Clinton's meeting with Prime Minister Miyazawa. The result of that trip, I think, will be very evident in the future. We made it very clear that an $80 billion trade deficit is unacceptable, and that it is even more unacceptable for $50 billion of that to be with one country. We've got to do something about that. We can't just sit on our hands. It would be absolutely irresponsible. And if the Japanese understand that the kind of imbalance that exists in our trade relationship is not good for their long-term economic interests, and we Americans understand that it's not good for our long-term economic interests, then people of goodwill ought to be able to get together and come to a meeting of the minds and figure out how to reduce it. And this administration is committed to an aggressive policy to make sure that we do reduce it, that we make sure that markets are truly open to our products. The last trip a couple of weeks ago was to Saudi Arabia. And some people said to me, why are you going to Saudi Arabia? And I made it clear that the reason I was going to Saudi Arabia was to stand with American business and industry. If President Mitterrand and Chancellor Kohl can get on an airplane and fly to distant parts of the world for the purpose of supporting French and German business and industry, this administration ought to do no less. We're going to be aggressive in the effort to be strong and effective advocates for American companies when they're competing against foreign interests in the global economy. And that trip demonstrated that. It was an opportunity to meet with King Fahd, who is about to make a decision involving about $10 billion worth of procurements. So I was there to support Boeing and McDonnell Douglas and Lockheed and Pratt & Whitney and General Electric and E-Systems and AT&T, all of which are bidding for those contracts, and to send a signal to the rest of the world that, yes, we are going to be there to put the weight of the American government behind our companies. We know that trying to get down that $50 billion trade deficit with Japan is going to be tough, but we believe that we can open that market if we are committed to tough and persistent negotiations. And this administration will exploit that open market by providing our citizens with education, training, and retraining in order to give our industries the skilled labor needed to build the high-quality, cost-competitive products that will allow us to compete in the global marketplace in the years ahead. The people of this nation have entrusted the President with a great mission, bringing us together, restoring our economic greatness, and moving us forward into the 21st century. I believe that the American people will scorn those who seek to thwart that effort. We are in a common struggle. We are putting divisions of region and race and class and gender behind us. Bill Clinton was elected to avoid the partisanship and special interest politics that have paralyzed us in the past. His election was, in fact, a wake-up call. It's time for all people of goodwill to get that message. We can, we must, we will revitalize the economy of our great nation and together build an America for ourselves, our children, and our grandchildren that lives up to its promise for all of its people. Thank you very much.